Hi, this is Xavier Schley from the Build Alaska podcast series. We've discovered some previously recorded legacy videos that were produced for the Construction Industry Progress Fund to help capture the contribution of a generation of Alaskans to the construction industry. We've digitized these videos to help preserve their content and make them available to the public.
Okay, Bob. Well, Henry, we've been kind of talking about the AGC here. We need to carry on, I think.
Bob, HEC, my connection with HEC has been that I was executive director for 10 years between 1990 and the year 2000. And the way that came about, I was hired at that time when they had the necessity for a new director. And at least what they told me, I was picked on the basis of my background. And it certainly wasn't my charm, that's for sure. But my background is that I came up in 1960. And unlike you, Bruce, I didn't have really a lot of choice. I came at the direction of Uncle Sam. I was with the United States Army at that time, with the engineers. And the way that came about, I grew up in Germany during World War II, and I immigrated from Germany in 1959. And they told me in my immigration visa not to look for any work or do anything because I only had 48 hours after landing to report to the next draft board. And that was part of the deal. I came over by boat the old way and landed on the East River. And I just went to the next recruiting station and says, here my papers say I got 48 hours to report. And they told me to not do anything, just hang around because I was going to get called on really fast. And within 2 weeks, they told me to report. And I was completely unattached, didn't have any family. I heard Wally Hickey came up here with 26 cents or something. Well, I came in the United States split-ass naked because the recruiter told me where to send my civilian clothes I had on, and I told him I didn't have anybody, so I threw them in the trash can. And so I started United States with absolutely nothing, just the way God created man. Well, they sent me up here, and I spent 3 years up at Ladd Air Force Base at that time, right outside Fairbanks. And during that time, it was changed into Fort Wainwright. And I was attached to the post engineers and did a lot of civil engineering stuff with the test range, with building all the roads that the Army needed and things of that nature. And one of the good deals about it was that, number one, I learned English. Army English is not of the highest standard, but nevertheless, it's in construction, it's not really a bad type of English to know. And the other thing was I had several job offers. At that time, the U.S. Geological Survey offered me a job, and Woody Johansson from the Highway Department in Fairbanks offered me a job. And he said, we just became a state, and we're building up a department, and I was a graduate engineer and came out of construction, and so I hired on with highways. My first job was down on the Delta Bridge, the bridge across the Tanana, and I spent 2 years down there, and actually the next 12 years I spent in the bridge construction. That became my specialty. And at that time, we worked with contractors mostly already. Those were specification-type contracts. They were a little bit different than they are now. But nevertheless, it was important from what you was telling. It was a change in the way things were getting done. And the construction industry was fully involved in the development. I was sent on the 8 bridges on Chino Hot Springs Road, and then I got onto the Parks Highway, Rex to Lignite, Lignite to Garner, Garner to Moody, and then ended up with the Hurricane Bridge. I spent 2.5 years down there. And after that, I got onto the pipeline business, I was the maintenance director for that region at that time, got in charge of the pipe hauling, and worked closely in that segment. And after that was done, there was an opening in Nome. That regional job came open, and I transferred to Nome in 1975, stayed there till my retirement in 1986, retired on the 30th of May, 86. I filed for the representative seat that was open the next day, got elected, spent a term as a representative in the state legislature for District 22. And then after I was done with that, I really realized that being in the legislature and being an engineer was not a real good mix, because that body down there is void of any logic, and engineers at least have to have a certain amount of logic. So I knew I was a misfit, and did not run for re-election, and then was hired by AGC and spent my time with AGC for 10 years, and retired out of there. And then that Knick Arm Bridge project came up. They created a separate law and a separate corporation, and I hired on with that and was there till just a few months ago. And now I'm just freelancing again. It's about my fourth retirement or something I'm in, so it's pretty interesting. It's been really truly a lot of fun. I really miss the old days. And when I look back, what are the big differences between then and now, and why was it more gratifying, and why was it that I felt I was doing something and I don't feel that way anymore? There are a lot of real discernible and easily to identify changes. I think probably the biggest changes that affected the construction industry and development first were all the vast changes in the assumption of power in the federal government to change all the laws and regulations with very broad-scaled laws. The environmental laws that goes from the Endangered Species Act to all the regulations to the Sea Mammal Act. As a matter of fact, in a duration of 10 years, there were 56 acts passed or large-scale regulations implemented that had incredibly pronounced effects. The wetlands, for just as an example, for Alaska. But also other things that affected the construction industry specifically, like health regulations, like all the things in camps, and how people's welfare and so on was affected. The safety laws in relation to all the regulations for equipment changes and so on, the methodologies, and for example, on bridges, safety nets and lanyards and things like that. Those were all very, very pronounced changes, and also affected the workforce highly. I'm not saying all of them were bad. I'm just saying they were all had a couple things in common. They affected pronounced changes and cost. Nearly all of them were associated with great costs. I kept track in those days when I was a project engineer. It also changed the way money was spent. When I hired on in 63, we spent 8% of a total cost of a project on pre-construction. That included right-of-way acquisition, design, and everything. In the duration of 10 years, that changed to 38%. And that is directly attributable to the changes affected by those laws. You all of a sudden had to examine things and evaluate things that we didn't do before. Maybe some things improved, but I clearly state that the relation of cost-benefit ratio is not there. We spend disproportionate amount of money that doesn't produce anything tangible, doesn't improve anything.
You know, Henry, you mentioned cost-benefit. that's something right there that does not exist anymore. That is never considered in the design of a project, cost benefit.
That's exactly right. And that was different. The second thing was that in those days you knew who was in charge. You had a district engineer, you had a commissioner, you had this and that. That person, if something went wrong, got kicked in the ass, and if he did something right, he got the Iron Cross. There was no passing the buck. Now we have multi-layered functions that are not even controlled by individuals. They are controlled by groups, by committees, by bodies. And as a consequence, accountability is something that is very elusive these days, and you can see it in the grossest of failures. Nobody gets fired, nobody gets called, and the reason is not that you don't know who it is, but the system doesn't allow you to get to it because it's so filtered, and it's like Gopher City. There are more holes to dive into in Switch than there ever were. The third thing is that you don't have what we used to call jack of all trades. When you had a project engineer, that guy knew how to build that road or how to build that bridge. Now you don't find those individuals anymore. Everybody, and it's not because the people are not as talented anymore or of a worse caliber or anything. The system has changed. It's like with the old family doctor. He ain't there anymore. You've got now groups of specialists, and everything is being approached by specialists in a group type setting. And what's lacking is that you have anybody who has enough moxie and experience and knowledge on top to be in an adjudicating position to say that's the more important thing or that's the more important thing. Now it's a democratic process that is on one big plane, and it doesn't come to a pyramid head, and as a consequence everything oozes around. There is no decisive control. There is no executive authority the way it used to be. And that's why we have uncontrolled cost overruns, slippage of schedules, nothing happening of time, costs doubling and tripling. Those are all those type of things. And it's a system more than a change in people. Then after that, in conjunction specifically with Alaska, there was ANSA and ANILCA. And that was the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, which was a major and very consequential piece that influenced everything in Alaska. And as a spin-off, ANILCA, the National Interest Lands Act, and the withdrawals of lands under D2 when Carter was president. There is nothing, in my opinion, as consequential to the development of Alaska than that was, because the disjointed application of ownership in the state, and some of it with great skill and foresight, to put it in such a pattern to disrupt any future development, especially with access, that is still hounding us and is not working in our best interests. So a lot of people wonder why are we where we are here and why is nothing happening. It's the change of times, but it's all the building blocks along the way that when you look at it in retrospect, were very skillfully executed stages by a group of people who had their own philosophies and were very apt to put that forward on a global basis. And we are seeing slowly now where everything is tied up in knots, where it is either too complicated or cost prohibitive to pursue development in a timely manner. And what we are having now, Nick Arm Bridge is a great example. We have spent so far $44 million in 3 years for environmental impact statement and have not reached a conclusion yet. And in Alaska especially, where we lack basic scientific things because of the history, it is nearly impossible under modern legal guidelines to come to some conclusions that say that's the only best way. Forever you're going to end up in court with differences of opinions, with political circles. And unless there is going to be some correction and change at some time, I don't see anything on the horizon to change that. And that's where groups like AGC, to come back to AGC, do have a very defined role, because just like some of the environmental organizations, we, the industry, and other broader public interests need to be represented in a similar manner to balance the whole approach again, because right now it is fairly one-sided. And HEC, I've been 10 years with them, and during that time we went through quite a few changes, as we mentioned already before. What an organization, what an industry organization like HEC is doing. There were a couple of things that took place during the 10 years which I saw very different. And I was in touch with my predecessors who were directors and so on. We changed from a social club into a functional organization. Example, we had, in the beginning, we had over 60 directors. And that basically meant anybody that paid sizable dues became a director. Okay, so everybody had something to say. Well, we completely reorganized, and we put it together in a structured committee approach, in an executive committee consisting of 7 directors who had the authority from the full board, so you didn't have, for every time you wanted to do a little change or something, you had to convene a whole board. The functions changed. The legislative committee now is a very, very, not, I wouldn't call it a powerful, but a very important committee, because that's where, through a feedback process, the whole industry has an input what the priorities should be for the industry, and then that gets through a lobbyist. We hired a lobbyist that gets directly accessed to the politics. We get involved in elections. We have a PAC and all those type of things. Those are evolutionary things which organizations like that change along. We already mentioned education now. We are networking with community colleges, with the Denali Commission, with the school districts, with the Department of Education, with the King Center, and with the Seward Training Centers and Hutchinson Center in Fairbanks, because they experience the same problems in a different setting. They get neglected in the funding and in the political process, so they realize the necessity for networking. And while they thought 10, 15 years ago that they were in a competitive situation with other groups like HEC, they realized, hey, we got to join together. Just like Fairbanks legislators, they always beat Anchorage legislators, because they said, hey, goal number one is get some money. Then we beat each other over the head who gets credit for it, if it's Democrat or Republican. And that's the same thing here. If you beat yourself up in the head beforehand, everybody is a loser. You got to get the bucket first, and then you divvy out what comes out of the bucket. So there are what I call progressive moves. But more important is, if you don't adjust to those changes in currents, you become a dinosaur. And that we are on the right track, and HEC is on the right track, is manifested by the fact about 20 years ago you had probably 20 groups that lobbied specifically, maybe a chamber representative or somebody in the legislature. Now you've got about 120 groups registered, yeah, and that are down there taking a haul, because each industry group and each, even nonprofits, are making a living getting direct legislative access and getting under the funding. And now, especially again with state having surplus money, I wouldn't be surprised if that number gets even bigger. Everybody has some idea what the public draft should fund. So it's there are exciting times. However, I say challenges are even getting bigger for two reasons. One, with the technology in the computerization in the electronic deal, you alluded to that, that is now what everybody aspires to be in. The whole global picture has changed. And while Alaska had always to be content trying to find its niche and trying to find its destiny within the national setting, all of a sudden the national setting has taken a different connection in regards to global interests. And then global interests are going to dictate, if we like it or not, what's going to happen in Alaska, what's going to happen in the United States, and what's going to happen in Alaska. And one thing already has, if somebody hasn't caught on to it, has reared its head, that's going to have outmost consequences, is that contrived businesses with global warming. And my prediction is within 2 years we are going to be in an incredible crisis that's going to transcend international levels, because the use of the Endangered Species Act right now in conjunction with the global warming issues are going to blanket everything in Alaska. The battle over the listing of the polar bear and the yellow-billed loon and the Kittlitz murrelet and the ripon seal and all that, those are nothing but tools by the global environmental movement to shut Alaska and pristine areas in Alaska down. And it's not limited to Alaska. They're doing the same thing with Canada, Siberia, the tropics, in each case with a different tool. But that global warming is going to be used, that the environment is going to change sufficiently that all those species that are affected by it need special protection or they're going to go extinct. And the Endangered Species Act, which, you know, goes back to 1972, that was one of the acts out of that when
Carter.
Actually it was, most people don't know it, it was Nixon who was president when most those acts
right.
were passed.
Yeah.
It can't blame that one on the Democrats. It was Republicans were in power then. But that's an interesting story in itself, how those acts have changed, primarily through judicial actions,
yeah.
and don't represent at all anymore what the original intent and purpose of those acts was. There's no resemblance anymore what originally they were supposed to do and what the reasons were they came into existence in the first place. But to come back to Alaska, those acts have real consequences in the lower 48s. We see, for example, those fires in Los Angeles. They weren't able to do anything because the black-tailed gnatcatcher and the spiny wood rat were endangered species, and they wouldn't let them remove that brush that fueled all the fire. There's Endangered Species Act, there's no if and buts. So what? So them homes burn down as long as the spiny wood rats arrive. That's the way the act is going. And we are seeing the same thing here. With the polar bear and the melting of the ice, if that stays, and we shouldn't forget, Endangered Species Act is only a U.S. act. It doesn't pertain to Canada or Russia. So all that stuff with polar bear protection on the polar area only pertains to Alaska's and the Alaska territorial waters.
Yep.
So the consequences are immense, and I don't know how that is going to play out. It may very well be that the pendulum is swinging too far, that there's finally awakening in the population of what is going on, and there may be enough pressure on the legislature to do it. But Bruce is absolutely right. We are spending incredible amounts of money, public and private, and have very little to show for in actual terms. That is a between how it was 50 years ago and how it is now. When you take a look, like I said, when I was there in the 60s, 92 cents on the dollar of an appropriation went into construction, went into there. Now we have passed the 50% mark. Not even 50% of an appropriation on highways goes into construction anymore.
Henry, you didn't touch on one thing that I think also affects, and maybe you want to address this. When you're, the days that you and I were here, we didn't have any money as a state. We were operating nickel dime, and you fought for dimes, not dollars. And when the oil companies came in and Alaska got oil rich, that also had a big influence on Alaska, and it had a big influence, in my opinion, on this inefficiency here, because we've got all kinds of people we're putting to work and jobs that don't need to be done, and they write each other memos, and all of them have an effect where they delay the project. Well, what's your opinion on that?
Well, that whole question about where's the money coming from, and one other thing in conjunction with that is we've got to give some praise to our congressional legislators, you know, because of the seniority system in Congress. It's no secret, and there's a lot of jealousy, that Alaska has done well. And, you know, our senior members, Senator Stephens and Don Young, regardless what the present situation is, they deserve incredible praise that they were very effective in getting the needs of Alaska as a developing state addressed in the nation. That, you know, there were all kinds of attempts, and are still all kinds of attempts now to change that.
Yes.
And but at the same time, with the so-called easy money, that type of accountability and that type of leanness goes out the window. And another thing which we often overlook is the change in the whole situation with contractors and firms. ANSA has made out of most of the native corporations, of the regional corporations, some very wealthy groups of people that used to be in a basic poverty before that. And it did two things. Number one, it created a leadership within the native community that is attuned to the way business is done, an understanding of corporate structure and how development takes place, and how important education and creation of a workforce is to the welfare of a native population. Before that, you know, subsistence is great, but it is more a cultural thing now than an economic thing. And you can take a look at ADNA and Siri and NANA and North Slope, how the whole lot of those people has changed. And they have now, through their subsidiary corporate structure, become very successful with the injection of the capital that they were entitled to under ANSA. And they have very skillfully done and made good use of it. And there is a very positive thing to see. At the same time, maybe those preferential laws, which our congressional delegation as part of that whole thing bestowed on them, is no longer valid. They have exclusive rights under federal procurement, and that was part, not all, but it was part of their success story that they had monopoly positions in a lot of those contracts and did very well with it. So it's but easy money is not necessarily a good thing to put
anywhere
a prudent or frugal program in effect.
I would like to make one comment here. I read poetry a lot, and there's a poet, there's a poem out, it's Elegy in a Country Churchyard by Gray. There's one line in there that I've always stuck with me: where wealth accumulates, men decay.
Well, that's...
And that's what's happening here.
Well, that's true, you know.
And we can see it in our daily operation.
Yeah, like I switched from cheap beer to more expensive wine. It's not a good thing.
That doesn't make you a bad guy in my book, Henry.
Yeah, but I think it were exciting times the last 50 years. And I think we even have more exciting times ahead because Alaska, because of its wealth, if and I mean all the things that are in the ground and all the renewable resources we have. We, together with Siberia and Canada, are in a global enviable position.
Unique.
If very unique.
Yeah.
And the technology that is continuing to be developed and progress. Just some things like directional drilling or things like that come to mind. The invention of new materials and so on. There's no doubt in my mind that the whole question of energy in the creation of cleaner, environmentally less consequential energy creation is going to take place. We're going to have breakthroughs. It may come out of outer space. It may come through some teenager having a new thought, but it's going to come. And that puts Alaska in a unique and very enviable position. And I think our greatest challenge is going to be to deal with adverse outside interests in the federal government to maintain our basic rights. That's the biggest challenge.
Should we secede, Henry?
Well, Joe Vogler, you know, God bless his soul, he may have not been altogether wrong.
You know, I've often looked at it. I've looked at, yeah, you mentioned Siberia. I haven't looked at that, but I've looked at northwestern Canada and Alaska, and we really do belong in that group. We don't belong with Seattle and California.
That's right.
And in that group.
Yeah. It's absolutely interesting, and, you know, I've been watching what Canada is doing with a great amount of interest because they created a new nation under native guidelines in there. In their sense in the Greenland, and with a lot of self-determination rights, but fully integrated into the Canadian governmental structure.
Yes.
And that is going to develop, if we like it or not, into a political force of some standing. And they're in the same boat. And of course, what happens in Siberia and in Russia, that is always a big puzzle because nobody has a handle on it, what is going to happen over there.
Yeah.
But I absolutely wouldn't be surprised if Siberia as a landmass is not necessarily going to secede from the Soviet Union, but Khabarovsk is nearly, from a standpoint of administration, functions as important as Moscow now for those eastern regions. They don't look to Moscow anymore like it used to be when the system was more totalitarian. So I think Siberia is, and the governance of Siberia is going to change too. And we all got the same basic aims, and that is careful development and making use of the resources that we have. But to get back to what our functions are, it's absolutely inconceivable that, number one, we don't have a good, well-thought-out strategic plan for transportation development in this state. Every governor and everything, every time we get a new mayor or a new governor or something, everything changes. Right now, I'm not sure what the aim is. Second, there is no multimodal plan. We don't see how sea and air and road transportation matters interconnect or how they should be developed. It's inconceivable. Now we have quite a bit of wealth, and there should be some kind of strategy in place that lays out some broad guidelines. What are our aims?
And that's where Hammond was smart. He didn't want to see transportation developed, and he put it all in the legislature's pocket so that they could parcel out the dollars. No concern
no
about
connection.
An overall plan
that's right.
or anything. I want it for my election district.
Yep. Each senator $5 million, each representative $1 million,
yeah.
and spend it whichever way is best to get reelected.
And you know that, and it doesn't take a brain surgeon to figure out that the population and all the representation is in urban Anchorage, urban Mat-Su, urban Kenai, and urban Fairbanks. That's where the money is. Four-lane highways and various out-of-sundry things that aren't really needed at this time are being built, mm-hmm. and that's because you got the money and you're going to spend it there, and the legislature wants to bring home the bacon.
Yeah.
And that's why you don't have a strategic plan. We had a strategic plan when I left in 75, And I got this secondhand, but Keith Hart was the planner for DOT at that time, or for Department of Highways at that time. Hammond called a meeting with all the people that were up in the departments prior to his election, and asked them what their department was doing and how they were going to do it, what their plan was. And the story I got from Keith Hart was he started telling Hammond what the plan was for highways. Hammond shut him off and says, "You don't need to tell us that because we aren't going to build any more highways in Alaska."
Hmm.
If that's what he said. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what he was.
Well, history would bear it out.
Yeah, history would bear it out. That's correct, yeah. And you know, no civilization can expand resource-wise or any otherwise, culture-wise, without good communication and transportation. Every civilization has had some kind of basic good transportation. The Roman roads, the British Navy, our railroads west in the U.S., the interstate system, all of those things have been instrumental in development.
Yep, that's absolutely right. And along those lines, I was in some meeting yesterday, is, you know, one of the shortfalls with the federal government is that they try to create rules and standards and things that are good for all 50 states. And there's nothing wrong with standards, okay? But what is lacking is enough variation for self-determination to adjust things to local conditions.
One size fits all doesn't work.
One size fits all, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, the costs have gone through the roof through the years for a variety of reasons. But, for example, most of the third world countries get developed, and they get developed with so-called low-volume road standards.
Yes.
And we don't have that.
The federal government.
To have that, but the federal government knocked it off. So now you've got to build a road to 60-mile-hour design speed for carrying enough traffic, so you have to have a 40-foot roadway and all that type of stuff. In rural areas,
you don't need that.
You can build twice the road for half the money by going to one-lane roads with turnouts at the right spots and all that type of stuff, but it's not allowed. You know, so we got to, you know, the necessity to have a state transportation system rather than
money.
Having a federal aid system only is long overdue, and it needs to be done.
You know, Henry, back in the olden days when I was here in the Road Commission, the BPR, we got X number of dollars for project to go from A to B. And you did the design, and if you couldn't get that design done for the money you had, you went back and changed things till you could get it done for the money that you had. There was none of the standards and whatnot. You got from A to B one way or another. That's what you had to do. That's what you're basically saying.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. And we got away from the functions at hand.
Yeah.
You know, the old mining roads, the miners did they didn't do one bit more than what they needed.
That's right.
And that is what it is. It's the application to your necessity. Mm-hmm. And that's not what we're doing.
Cost benefit.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yep. Exciting times. So, you know, we're getting in the age. I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to do the next 30 years. Because, you know, I believe in medicine. We're going to get older and older and older.
And better looking. Yeah.
Well, I won't go there.
Henry, it's been fun. Do we have? Will you want some more here?
I think. Do you have anything that you can think of that we're missing?
I can tell you this story. What happened? I only told you what happened between 8 and 5. Now I can give you a lot more insight. What happened between 5 and 8?
I'm ready.
I don't think we better go there.
No, we better not go there. You can look at it in a police blotter, and you find some of my history right in there. It's a matter of public record.
Yeah.
I tell you how bad the roads in Nome were, which I was in charge of. I had to drive on the sidewalk in Nome in order to get around with my car. And police did not like it. The judge didn't like it either.
I understand, and you didn't like the fact that the jail was smoking.
Yeah, I didn't like that they had that the trooper was smoking in the jail. I demanded a non-smoking cell, but didn't get anywhere. Okay, well, I think you get the...
We've got a lot to work with.
Yeah, you got a lot to work with.
Well, you got a lot of opinions from us, and
that's good, but we got a lot of history, too.
Yeah, I think there are fewer and fewer people. I'm a truly a believer that how did we get here? You know, it's the same thing when you drive with your rig and you're floorboarded, you're stuck, you're not moving anymore. He says, how in the hell did I get here? You know, you knew it was getting soft. You said, the hell with it. You floorboarded it, or you should have eased out, or you should have got your ass out and look ahead or something, but you didn't. And that's the way I feel we are sometimes here. We're stuck. And how in the hell we get here? We didn't get here because we ran over the cliff or we didn't make a curve. It was like a woodpecker or a beaver on a tree. It was steps,
inch at a time, yep.
Step by step by step by step. And it's not going to get undone with a chainsaw and cutting it off either. It's going to have to be eased out again, just like you try to check a car out. It's not going to get in one swoop, well, because it ain't going to be a revolution, you know. But the screw can continue. It's going to be by necessity. We are already there. The dollar is going down anywhere. Our debt level is getting to the point where it's not bearable. We are paying more and more out of the budget for interest. The entitlement programs are not working because of a variety of factors. But that screw is seizing up. I don't know when it is going to be. They figured out Social Security is going to go to hell in 1928 or 32. And you can, by putting all of the factors in the computer, it probably can tell you pretty good when the present system is going to come to a halt. And those acts are going to get readjusted. I guarantee you the Endangered Species Act is going to get revisited because it's so rigid that the courts can't adjudicate any other way than what they're doing. I'm not blaming that one on the courts. There are no provisions for interpretation in that act. And therefore, something has to give, because the way it is right now is what we have here with the bears and the people. It's either going to be the bears or the people. It's not going to be coexistence of the two. And that's the way it's going to be with the Endangered Species Act. The way it's going right now is it's going to be yellow-billed loon or people. And that's it. And so something's going to give. The trouble politically is that it's too isolated here. It's for the rest of the other 48 or 49 states, it's not a problem yet. But with that globalization, where they are now going to adjust all the energy standards and tax coal plants and electricity and power and pollution, it's going to go everywhere. It's moving to blanket everything. And that's when the awakening is going to come, just like $4 a gallon on gas. That all of a sudden wasn't just here anymore, that was everywhere, and all of a sudden it became a political problem. And that's going to be with energy and that whole thing.
And it changed the American thoughts about what's right and wrong like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Pickup sales went down the tube and small cars, just like that.
Just like that, exactly.
Yeah. And it's going to take that kind of action. It's going to have to, you've got to do something to get to everybody's head. I remember when this environmental thing first came out and we had public hearings, I tried to get the Chamber of Commerce, the AGC, various people to go to these public hearings and let us hear the other side. I said, if all I hear is all in these environmental people, I have to say I have to go with the gospel.
That's right.
You guys get out and tell me the other side of this thing. And boy, nobody would get out. Everybody was comfortable where they were.
That's right.
Yeah. And now this is the effect. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, that's why I'm saying it. The pendulum is going to swing at one time by necessity. Otherwise, it's just going to be.
So the people are suffering either economically or physically or some way so that they rebel.
That's right.
It doesn't have to be a rebellion per se. It's individual rebellion. We're not going to let this happen anymore, but we're not there yet.
No. Yeah. No, but, you know, that global business and that Kyoto Treaty, you know, because what they're doing with those international, the Rio de Janeiro Treaty and the Kyoto Treaty, that was signed on by 70-some nations, and they are forcing the big eight to finance the whole
bit,
global deal like United Nations by treaty, you know.
Yeah.
And I applaud the last two presidents. I mean, even old was there, they resisted ratifying the Kyoto Treaty, and that's what they are trying to do now with the global deal.
Yeah.
That is just a continuation.
Yeah.
And as soon as we sign on, then you're going to see also. Then we are tied into international contracts, and we have to start doing all that stuff, where all of a sudden all the power plants get taxed separately, and the energy costs are going to go just like where gasoline is going, and then it comes to a head.
Yep.
Gentlemen, this has been fun.
Okay, we'll get out of here.
Okay.
Well, we're all tied up.
Yeah, I'm not moving.
Thank you for listening to the Alaska Works Podcast, brought to you by a generous contribution from the Construction Industry Progress Fund and the Associated General Contractors of Alaska.